You are not alone. And now there are two resources that I've put together specifically for your journey. This is your host, Rachel Bernstein. I am an educator and a therapist and a cult specialist. And I am very excited to announce Restart and Restore, a journal for survivors of manipulation, and a companion notebook that I've put together to go with it that has people's stories that they've shared with me that they wanted to share with you, and some wonderful quotes from people whose thoughts I truly admire, and more pages and writing prompts for you to continue with the writing that can help you along your healing journey. This isn't just another blank journal. It's a trauma-informed recovery companion, and it offers psychoeducation on the mechanics of manipulation and control and therapeutic writing prompts to explore your history and your strengths, practical exercises that transform insights into some actionable steps, and the freedom to heal at your own pace. You can do it in the time frame that works for you without any judgment or pressure. Whether you joined the organization or the relationship that was controlling as a teen or as an adult, Restart and Restore provides the structure and, I think, validation needed to process your experiences safely. I'm also excited to share, beyond the journal and its companion notebook, that I'm currently working on a second journal specifically for those born and raised in high-control groups or high-control family units, as their healing journey often involves different and specialized challenges. Restart and Restore and its companion notebook are available now, and you can find the link in the show notes. Thank you very much. I hope it's helpful to you or to someone you love.
Welcome to Indoctrination, a weekly conversation series about protecting yourself from systems of control. I'm your host, Rachel Bernstein.
Hello, everyone. Today on the show, we have Lucas Wilson. Dr. Lucas Wilson is an SSHRC postdoctoral fellow at the University of Toronto in Mississauga and was formerly the Justice, Equity, and Transformation postdoctoral fellow at University of Calgary. He is the author of Shame, Sex, Attraction, fantastic name, Survivor Stories of Conversion Therapy, and the author of At Home with the Holocaust, Post-Memory, Domestic Space, and Second-Generation Holocaust Narratives, which won the Jordan Schnitzer First Book Publication Award. His public-facing writing has appeared in The Advocate, in Queerty, in LGBTQ Nation, and Religion Dispatches, among other venues. He's currently working on a new edited collection about LGBTQ plus experiences at Christian colleges and universities, seminaries, and divinity schools. And it was a total pleasure to talk to him. We had a great conversation, and I hope we get to talk again soon. Here's Lucas now. I am so very happy to be talking to Dr. Lucas Wilson today. This is a conversation I've really been looking forward to. These are subjects I care deeply about and have talked about on the show over the years. But it is so important to talk about someone who's had firsthand experience and also has researched so much and put so much out there and has studied so much. It is great to have you on the show. I'd love you to take a moment to introduce yourself.
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate being here. So my name is Luke, or Lucas Wilson, whichever you prefer. Just don't call me late for supper, I suppose. I'm currently a Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council postdoctoral fellow at University of Toronto Mississauga, formerly the Justice, Equity, and Transformation postdoctoral fellow at University of Calgary. And before that, I was an eternal student. And so I was in grad school for quite some time and have taught at different institutions across North America. And most of my past research, I guess in some senses, my current research as well, it's just sort of side projects, was in Holocaust studies. I largely looked at the influence of Christian theology in laying the seedbed for the Holocaust, as well as the antecedents of the Holocaust. So looking at intergenerational transmission of trauma between survivors, their kids, and their grandkids. But I shifted gears for a number of reasons, and we can talk about some of those. And I now focus largely on white Christian nationalism, specifically the intersection of gender and sexuality, and more particularly looking at conversion practices, or what has traditionally been referred to as conversion therapy. And I look at it again in evangelical, white Christian fundamentalist, Pentecostal, and again, more broadly, white Christian nationalist contexts. And so I think that's what we're going to be talking a little bit about today.
Yes, we are. I am so excited to be able to get into all these subjects. Like I said, I mean, I could go on for 8 to 10 hours, but I won't do that to you or to the listeners. And yes, I would love to be able to talk about epigenetic transmission and a lot of things that make me sound smart that I know the word, but also it is really, really important. It reminds me just to start, and then I want to get into your experience and what led you to this. I remember, and something I talked briefly about on the podcast a while back, but I remember when I was living in New York, I was reading the Times, which you did when you're on the train, and there was a way to fold the Time. This is before it was online, really, or that people had phones in that way. And you would fold the paper vertically so that you would make enough space between you and the next person. And I remember reading this article that was luckily vertically kind of aligned. And it was about this group of school children from an evangelical school that were brought to the Holocaust Museum. And they did an interview with them, elementary school kids, when they left this museum, asking them what they had learned. And they all said the same thing, which was, we learned that this is what happens when you don't believe the way you should. And I thought, what? They spent a whole day there and they saw pictures of other children their age who had been slaughtered, et cetera, et cetera. But there was this sort of cool distance in the way they approached it, the way they were taught to see it. I wonder if, as they have gotten older now, if they sort of see it differently, but it was disheartening. And also fascinating to see how that could happen, how you could just have this lens through which you see things and you don't actually have to feel anything for the people who went through something. It was actually chilling.
Just reminds me in general how desensitized so many evangelicals or white fundamentalists or folks from high control religious contexts are, that they don't see the world in the same terms as many folks do. And it's this distance between reality and themselves. And they keep that distance, and it's largely theological, but it's also deeply social at how folks see the other, how folks see anyone but themselves. And this lack, this raging lack of empathy is endemic to so many Christian traditions. And I think we can see that here in this case, thinking about Jews during the Holocaust. And of course, I would only assume that anti-Semitic tropes came up and informed those opinions. Who killed Jesus? Well, Jews killed Jesus, according to so many Christian traditions, even though it's clearly not even stated in the scripture. But putting that aside, not looking for intellectual consistency here. But I think that that's just one example of many. And of course, we're going to be talking about LGBTQ folks and communities and individuals. And there's, of course, a really profound inability to put oneself in the shoes of another, in this case, queer folks or trans folks. But again, it goes for women. It goes for people of color. It goes for so many folks who are other, that there is this chilling, I think the word you use, this chilling lack of empathy that is pervasive across these religious traditions.
Yeah, it really is incredible. And people also know who have listened to this podcast. In my family, a lot is woven into my own family system and my children, a variety of different orientations and children who are trans, and are going to be spending their life with other people who are trans and engaged to be, which is exciting. But also, I think that there is something that is important to mention, which is that I feel like just as a human, whether or not this is woven into your life, I think it's important to care about people's ability to just be and to know that they are okay. That I hear from a lot of people who I've worked with who have come out of certain situations that they just, the word mistake is used way too frequently. In fact, if it's just used once, it's way too frequently, but that they feel like they were a mistake. If you believe in God, God doesn't make mistakes. So the whole thing, like you're talking about sort of logical accuracy, sequencing, it doesn't come together at all. That here, God is perfect, but also God makes mistakes. What does that mean? And somehow it all gets explained away and justified away, which I'm sure you've seen 1,000 times more than I have just through your personal experiences.
Yeah, even using this idea that this cognitive dissonance, that they hold the belief that God is perfect, God who doesn't therefore make mistakes, and then that they're a mistake. And I think that this sort of thinking lends itself so well to thinking, okay, so if we believe that God is perfect and God doesn't make mistakes, God's also the giver of all good gifts, that God gives everything that is good in the world. And if God really wants me, and if we're thinking about young queer folks, young trans folks, people who are different, gender and sexual minorities, if God wants me to be different and I can't be different, even though all of us gave it that good old college try, we really tried to become straight. Nowadays, not so much of a goal, but at the time, it certainly was made for us. And I think when you see that you're not changing, and again, according to this perfect God, God wants you to change and you're not changing. Well, the problem's not God. The problem's there for you. And you see yourself as a problem. Of course, that's a problem. It's this cognitive dissonance that they hold these different, what they believe to be truths, but oftentimes contradicting sort of realities in tension. And they find a way through a number of mental gymnastics and they have to perform in order to hold these beliefs in tension or together or side by side or in some sort of relationship, whatever the spatial metaphor is. I think that it really feeds into a wildly death-dealing and damaging ethos and also just way of thinking, which of course informs how you live in the world. And these communities breed this thinking. That's why I think that we see such damage done to so many folks who don't fit that mold, whether it be the heteronormative mold, whether it be the white dominant mold, whether it be the androcentric mold, whatever it might be. If you don't fit that and you're outside of that, well, there are consequences in multiple senses. And I think at least what we're talking right now are spiritual, emotional, and psychological, amongst others.
Oh, absolutely right. So to go to your experiences, let's start with that because that drove a lot of this, but I think also just your nature being someone who wanted to do something with all of this, which is really lovely, is important. I think also just to say that we're going to be, along with a lot of other people, sensitive to the word therapy when it goes along with conversion, similar to when people, they've been kidnapped to go to some of these fraudulent teen treatment places and somehow still called treatment. I'm aware that the word doesn't match what happens there, but I'm curious, yeah, to hear about your younger years and what that experience was like for you.
Yeah, I feel like anytime the word conversion is placed next to another word, you know you're in trouble, right? And of course, what we're talking about, conversion therapy, there's no conversion, there is no therapy. The term is a misnomer. However, it is the best known sort of phrase that names what we're talking about when we talk about what we're talking about today. So I grew up in Toronto, Ontario, dirty riding Canadian, the youngest of 5 kids. I grew up in a family that was not a religious family. I always say that my mom was haunted by her Baptist demons. She grew up in a Baptist household, and because of that, she really held on to a lot of the fears and anxieties that come with the Baptist tradition. And the conservative Baptist tradition specifically. And so I had that as this dark cloud in the house, I suppose, haunted by Jesus. But my dad was an agnostic. He was this hippity-dippity, vegetarian, pot-smoking, record store-owning social worker. Like, he was just this phenomenal human. And then there was my mom. And she was just...
And then there was my mom.
And there was Cheryl. And Cheryl was a different sort of person. When we were little... And I'm the youngest of 5. And for anyone who's watching, here's the Wilson family. So 1993. I'm the young child with the mullet at the bottom. Things don't change. But we went to this Baptist church on and off. maybe a 10-minute walk from our house. I was, again, the youngest, and so I had the least exposure to church. When we were going, which was not always, we would go here and there. But by the time I was in about grade 2 or 3, like any good Canadian family, we went to the cottage instead. So if you went to like our summer home down in Niagara, we just stopped going to church. And so I had a little bit of an exposure to church, but even in the random week that we would go on Sunday, Sunday alone once, it was kind of like you'd go to Sunday school, you'd go to Sunday service, you'd come home and you'd shut the hell up about Jesus. Jesus was just not a topic of conversation. My mom taught me how to say my prayers and how to say grace. That was it. There was just no discussion of God in the household. We were not by any means a Christian family. We were a family who sometimes went to church on and off and then stopped going altogether. Now, if we fast forward to when I was just about to get into high school, my brother got really into the creation versus evolution debate. And because of this, he was like, Luke, you've got to watch these DVDs of this creationist who was debating all of these university professors and whatnot. And the creationist was Kent Hovind, if you know him, Dr. Dino from Pensacola, Florida. He eventually went to jail because he said the money he owed the government was God's money and the government clearly disagreed. So he went to prison. But Kent Hovind was the one whose DVDs we were watching. And so at first I was like, no, I don't want to watch Creation versus Evolution DVDs, Quinn. Thanks, though. What an offer. But then eventually I sort of acquiesced and I did. Because of the nature of these debates where Kent Hovind is just this bombastic, in-your-face orator, he's really just kind of a punk. Nonetheless, for a young, you know, impressionable, you know, I guess it would have been 14 at this point, mind, I was hooked. I was like, this guy is sort of entertaining. He seems to have a point. And as a result, after watching a number of these, I went down some rabbit holes on the internet trying to find more creationists like Ken Ham out of Kentucky, though he's Australian. Anyway, and I started watching all of this kind of stuff and reading all this kind of stuff. I thought, okay, if I believe that there is a creator, an intelligent designer, then I should probably go and figure out who that is. And in my young, impressionable mind, I thought, well, it's the God I was raised to believe when I was little, when we were going to that church. And so I went back to the church that we had gone to, and it was a Fellowship Evangelical Baptist church, which is pretty similar to like a Southern Baptist tradition. I think there are churches, Feb Central churches in the States, but it's mostly, from my understanding, it's a lot of them are in Canada. And so I went to this church, and I really didn't stop going for my entirety of high school. And eventually, when it was time to make my decision on where I was going to go to university, I was really between two schools. And the two schools were University of Toronto, which is arguably Canada's best university, and Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia. And for those who don't know what Liberty is, count your blessings. But for those who do know what it is, it's Jerry Falwell's university. It's a high control, formerly white Christian fundamentalist turned evangelical institution, though at this point, I don't think there are too many necessary distinctions between these two religious traditions. But it was this school that was hyper theologically conservative, but also incredibly politically conservative. I went down and I officially majored in English, but I think it's more accurate to say that I got an education in conservative theology and politics from a Southern Baptist perspective. And so that's how I got to Liberty. It was really just making my decision between these two schools. But when I was making the decision between U of T, University of Toronto, and Liberty, I decided that I was going to, or I was making some sort of like a checklist to figure out, okay, what school should I go to? One check for this school, for this positive element, one check for this. The only thing that I actually put down as two checks was the fact that Liberty had a conversion therapy program. Now, I didn't conceptualize it as conversion therapy at the time. I didn't think of it in those terms, but I did think of it as, oh, Liberty has a pastor who I knew about, who was on staff, who worked with gay students in order to help them deal with their same-sex attractions, as Liberty and the wider high-control Christian world puts it. And so really a big reason why I went to the school was because I thought that if I went there, I could become straight. And so I went. I can give you more details about knowing exactly how I went into the program, but eventually I found myself in a one-on-one session with this university employee. His name is Pastor Dane Emmerich, not a licensed professional, not a licensed counselor. I actually don't even think he has a master's to be seen. In either case, I met with him over the tenure of my undergrad, which was 4 years, and it was that work that I did with him, neither therapy nor treatment, but the work, quote unquote, that I did with him had long-lasting implications, and it wasn't just was at Liberty, but had a life of its own beyond.
Oh my goodness. So I'm curious, just sitting in that room with him for that first time, what was that like? I mean, what did it make you feel or feel about yourself? I mean, were you feeling like, oh, good, I'll be able to be relieved of this, or that I'm in good hands, or something feels off. Just curious about your read.
I think because I had been trained as a good evangelical to always trust authority and to defer to authority, I didn't question anything. He was in charge. And so if he had said, I can help you with this, I was trained to believe that he's going to help me with this. Whatever he does and whatever means necessary, he's going to bring me to the place that I need to be, which is to find attraction to women. So what had happened was that I had two spiritual life directors on my dorm. There were two RAs, under them two spiritual life directors, under them a bunch of what Liberty referred to as prayer leaders, and then the rest of us plebeians who weren't religious enough to be on leadership. And so I had a really bizarre sort of one-night rendezvous with one of my spiritual life directors. He had made a move on me. I said, sure. And the rest was history. After that, he refused to talk to me. And he was like, in a way, excommunicated from everything. Like, I really didn't do any, not that I even liked my dorm. My dorm, some of the most like bad faith, nasty, nasty people I've ever met in my life was from this dorm. But I was like, okay, I'm going to separate myself as much as possible because he was there and he didn't want to talk to me and he wouldn't talk to me. And I was heartbroken. Like, I was so sad because I thought, here's my first romantic moment and did not go the way that I thought it would. And I was distraught. And because of that, I had fast-tracked my plan. My original plan was that when I went to Liberty, because when I was in high school, I went to a public secular high school. I never wanted to be a bad witness for Jesus, never wanted to give Jesus bad PR. So I never did anything with anyone because I thought if they think, oh, this guy's a Christian and he's out there dating guys, well, geez Louise, he must not be a Christian and Jesus must not be who Jesus says Jesus is. So I didn't do anything. I was a very straight-laced, good young evangelical at my school. But when I got to Liberty, I thought in my mind, when I'm there, if everyone else is a Christian and I'm a Christian, no one's going to think poorly of Jesus if I date Christian guys. So I can go out and date whomever. I'll be well, but then eventually by the time I end at Liberty, just before I graduate, I can go to meet this pastor who can help me become straight, find a woman, any woman will do, because of course, within the evangelical imagination, all women are the same. Find a woman, marry her, and off to Canada I go. This was my big idea. And I think in part formed because I was not fully within the evangelical world in the sense that I didn't grow up in it. So I had a little bit of, critical distance, but at the same time, I was more in the camp than not, but I digress. This was my big plan. Clearly, it didn't work because the first guy who I go on a date with, it blows up in my face. And I thought, well, geez, Louise, I need out of this. I need some sort of reprieve because I was distraught. I was super upset. And I only had one friend on campus with whom I could speak about this because we both sort of stumbled and fumbled over ourselves and came out to each other one night. And after we came out to each other, I could talk to him. But I thought to myself, well, I don't want to burden just him with all this emotional baggage that I'm clearly carrying. So I said, okay, I'm going to fast track my idea, my plan, and I'm going to go and meet with this pastor. And so this is now my way of answering your question. I had all this backstory, but here we are. So to actually answer your question, I get to the room and it was in one of these back academic wings. Liberty has this massive academic building, if we can be so generous with the term academic when describing what goes on in those halls, but neither here nor there. And behind this big building, there are all these academic wings. And in one of them, this was where the student care office was. So there was the geology department over here. And then like a few doors down, there were these like student services. And so I was in one of these wings. I go to the room and I remember I signed in. And the guy who I signed in with was clearly gay himself. You walked in and you're like, okay, this guy's gay just like me. And so that was sort of ironic. That was my first entrance into this world. And then I was directed to go sit in this prayer room. And inside the prayer room was Pastor Dane's office. So I went inside this prayer room and I remember sitting there terrified. I'm thinking to myself, gee, oh my gosh, do I run? Do I stay? I know he had told me in an email that whatever I said to him would remain confidential unless I was to physically harm myself. And that was never a plan. That was never an idea. So I thought, well, nonetheless, what if he tells on me? What if he tells the administration? What if he tells my RAs? Or what if he tells my mom? So I'm sitting there terrified. I thought, like, do I just get the heck out of here? Do I leave? And I'm sitting in this prayer room and I'm looking around. There's like a girl over here praying and I'm sitting there in front of his door. Anyway, finally, he opens the door. Out walks one student, and then he looks directly at me and he says, Luke or Lucas, whatever name I used at the time, probably Lucas, my birth name. I said, yeah. And he says, come on in. And so I walked in. I still remember I was wearing this cherry red American Eagle hoodie. Looking back, I should have been so much more embarrassed about wearing American Eagle than being gay. But, you know, here we are now. Hindsight's 2020. So I walk in and I sit down and it was this very dimly lit, almost romantic lighting. And I sit down, he has his chair directly across as my chair. He sits, I sit, and he I think within seconds, I was just sort of distraught and like, oh my gosh, I don't want to be gay. This is something I've been struggling with for so long. I've had no one to talk to. Also, recently, I said, I don't know if I'm going to get in trouble for this, but I did have this weird sort of like encounter with my spiritual life director. And anyway, just sort of spilled the beans and told him precisely why I was there. In the beginning, he was this grandfatherly type, very soft-spoken, very calm and put together or seemingly put together. When I first met him, it felt like I was, again, he was an authority. He was a nice guy, seemingly, and he had my best interests front and center. And so I felt quite good. And that first meeting, he gave me some homework, and it was where I had to do essentially like an inventory of my personal or family relations, which is, of course, like a very pseudo-Freudian approach to human sexuality. Like, what was your relationship like with your mom, with your dad? And so came back with my homework done the next meeting and shared with him. And we sort of had to try to come to terms with, okay, what exactly, what's the source, the roots of my same-sex desire? We chatted about this. And those were the first initial meetings where we were trying to figure out, where exactly did this come from? What we landed on was that it wasn't my dad, it was my mom.
What a shock.
Yeah. Always blame the mother.
Right. As they say with Freud, if it's not one thing, it's your mother. Here you go.
And you know what? I think they take their cue from Adam and Eve. God's like, who did this? And Adam's like, she did. It's always just blaming the woman.
Exactly. And we have no idea about those stories and also how they were translated. Now, there's also something I've talked about on the podcast about this guy who studies ancient languages and the real translation of biblical words and noticing that Eve did not come from Adam's rib, that that's a mistranslation, et cetera, et cetera, and that Eve came from Adam's side. So they were side by side, equals. You just can't have that. It doesn't work, even though that is what it said. Anywho, so let's go back. So yes, it wasn't your dad, but it was your mom.
It was Cheryl. It was because she was overbearing. Keith, my dad, I was very close to him. He died when I was 16, so he died just before I got to Liberty, about 2 years before. We agreed, Dane and I, my conversion therapist and I, agreed that it must have been my mom. I still remember in the first meetings, he kept pushing this question, like, were you sexually abused? And I was like, no. And he's like, are you sure? And I'm sitting there thinking, like, is the answer yes? Do I have to say yes? Like, is that what he wants? And I kept saying, like, not to my knowledge. Like, I don't have any recollection of being abused or molested or anything like that. But he kept pushing it. And you could tell that he was kind of like, huh, leaving the door open for when I want to come out of the closet, I guess, in a double sense, and tell him that I was molested, which clearly had not happened. He was giving me that allowance. Anywho, so those were the first meetings where we had this get to know each other. And again, really understanding, at least trying to understand, at least according to his terms, where all this came. After that, it was very much a routine procedure. I'd go in, he'd give me a big bear hug. It was always this big, enthusiastic, perhaps overly enthusiastic bear hug. We'd sit down, we'd start chatting, and I would give an inventory at that point of my weekly slip-ups and my weekly victories. Slip-ups were moments that I gave into temptation. Victories were moments where I resisted temptation. And so we would talk about those, and he always wanted a lot of detail, particularly about the slip-ups. And again, looking back, I think we can all see why. But putting that aside, we would talk about that. Afterwards, we would read scripture together. We would pray together. Though whenever we prayed, he always prayed for me, never me praying for myself, which I think is quite indicative of how he interceded on my behalf. And I didn't necessarily have a voice in a lot of senses. And then we read this book. My book was Alan Medinger's Growth into Manhood, Resuming the Journey. And Alan Medinger was one of the former presidents of Exodus International. And this is the book that we read. He gave other books to other students, but this was the book that I had. And so we would go over and talk about it and chat about the things that I was learning in there, how to become a man, how to act like a man, and things that I needed to do, like play sports, read the sports section in the newspaper, do carpentry, like very Jesus of him, right? These sorts of things. A lot of the time that we would spend was talking about this. And then, you know, he'd pray, finish our meeting, and then give me another really enthusiastic bear hug. But one thing that I think blocked out of my head for a while was that when I was talking to a friend one time, he also met with Dane, and he said to me that when they would pray together, Dane would put his hand on his leg. And all of a sudden, the moment he said this, I was like, same. What it was that my friend described it as not being so far down on your leg that you didn't clock it, but not so far up that you had to say stop. So it was always towing that line. And again, I kind of didn't really think about this for a long time. To be honest, I didn't think about a lot of this for a really long time, because I had other things I had to think about in the moment. And we can get to that in a second. And that was really grad school. But these were the ways that we would meet. And these is the content of our meetings. I've talked to some people about this, and even in the past where I published little articles or whatever online about this experience, and people who have the audacity to say, that doesn't sound so bad, which in its own right, I think it's a weird thing to say. But if I were to entertain that argument and say, okay, like if what you're saying doesn't sound like horrible, what he said, you know, how to sit, how to act, how to be in general senses, or in also specific senses, I oftentimes think about the violence of conversion therapy specifically for me that happened after. And that is to say, we were talking before, you know, how when folks are made to believe that they're a problem, things aren't changing. And for me, when I left Liberty and I didn't have that weekly reassurance from Dane that all things were well, God's on God's throne and everything's right in the world, and you're doing what you need to do to keep fighting, keep fighting. When I didn't have that weekly, quote unquote, encouragement, and I was really in the real world, no longer within the Liberty bubble, no longer within the sacred canopy, I think it was then that I realized things are not changing. And up until that point, I had really convinced myself and kept having to convince myself with the assistance of Pastor Dane that everything was working and things were changing. And I was seeing victory over my temptation. But of course, nothing was changing. Everything was exactly the same. And it was then that the guilt that I had felt whenever I had done something wrong, where I was like, oh, I've done this discreet action. I looked at a man lustfully. Gosh, I need a slap on the wrist in the court of law, guilty for that action. But I myself am not a bad person. I just am guilty for that one thing, even though, of course, evangelicals think that everyone's horrible no matter what. All righteousness is filthy rags before God. But in this sense, I was able to distinguish my guilt from my shame. And I felt guilty for the things I had done, those individual discrete actions. But when I left Liberty and I realized things weren't changing, that guilt was no longer just guilt, but that negative feeling that I felt for what I had done was not just directed towards that one action. It was directed inward toward me. And I, as a person, was dirty. I, as a person, was defective, damaged, sinful. And in some cases, depending on how you see it, and I guess your theology within different Christian traditions, demonic. Like I was affected by demons, if not had a demon in me kind of thing. This is where, again, it wasn't just guilt, it was shame. And then on top of that, there was that self-hatred. And it was just the snowball effect of really horrible affects or emotions that came together to create a really poor self-image that I had to then, of course, work through for years and years and years through therapy, through grad school and beyond. And so if anyone is to say, oh, well, it sounds like your experience in the moment in conversion therapy doesn't sound so bad, what I always think about now is really the aftermath. And that's where the violence of conversion therapy for me really occurred. And that's, again, what I've been dealing with or I've had to deal with for quite some time.
You bring up such an interesting point. Well, so many interesting points, but there's something about people negating your experience, just saying, well, it doesn't sound like it was that bad. I mean, people have heard horror stories and there are horror stories, you know, electrodes and horrible things. That's all very real. And so if it didn't happen to you in that way, what you're talking about is let's not deal with those details. Let's deal with how I've learned to see me. And the hopelessness, the fact that then you're not going to feel deserving of good things, of happiness. You can't envision a future. You think you're walking around and feeling like a bad person, and maybe that's how you're seen by the world or that's how you're seen by God. It is so invisible. And so things that are invisible can be discounted. But I just imagine the weight that you were carrying and how it was probably hard to plan for any kind of future, because who were you and who were you going to be able to be in God's eyes, and were you going to be okay, and were you going to be loved or lovable? I mean, I think it brings up so many huge existential questions that are really hard to walk around with without what you think is support, even though that's not at all what you were getting. It's very confusing. And devastating, I think also in its invisibility, because people don't know how much you're suffering.
I think that's exactly it. The idea of a future, and what would a future mean for me as a young evangelical if I were to embrace my sexuality? Because within the evangelical imagination, of course, emphasis on imagination, one cannot be queer and a Christian. I'm no longer a person of faith, but at the time I was, and I was trying to navigate, how do I see myself in a full sense? And I could not, in my theological imagination, understand myself as both queer and as a person of faith. Was no future for me. There was no queer future for me. There was only, in that, again, theological imagination, a future for me as a follower of Jesus. And of course, that's read between the lines, you know, straight. And since I was not finding any success in becoming straight and never would, I lost all hope. That's exactly it. This idea of futurity, of this idea of where do I go from here? Well, there was nowhere. That was blocked. There was a wall. And so if you're encountering a wall and there's nowhere to go, to your point, it's this wonderfully, in the sense of like it being this wonder, this horrible, maybe like terrifying loneliness, this terrifying sadness and stagnant state where there was no progression, there was no future, there was no tomorrow, there was only now. And it was, again, to your point, hopeless. And I think that you're giving language right now actually to something that is a really profound way of putting it. When you have no hope and you have no future, I mean, really, what do you have?
Right? What do you have? You can't look towards something. You can't think. It might even feel like a luxury to plan for something. And here you're someone who went so far forward in your life. And so, of course, we then need to hear about how that happened, because it was like against all odds for you to go on with your education, for you to build a life, because you had to fight against all of this self-talk. I have a feeling that there was a cacophony in your head all the time. And the hard part is sometimes you hear the negative self-talk in other people's voices. When you start to hear it in your own voice, that's devastating. Because then you think, oh, I actually have taken that on as now my own thought, my own way of looking at me. Then you have to fight against that. So I'm wondering then how you were able to kind of transform yourself in order just to start to take the steps moving forward, thinking that there was a forward.
I still remember there was one night I was in my MA. I was at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, just an hour away from Toronto. And I was in my split-level apartment and I was doing my dishes after dinner, and it was just the light above the sink on, sort of dramatic. I didn't mean for it to be dramatic, but I guess it was looking back. I was about to go and have a drink with one of my friends at the on-campus pub, but I was just finishing the dishes before I left. And I remember standing there thinking to myself, what in the world, God? And praying and saying, it just doesn't make sense why it's not, in your eyes, okay to be gay. At the time, I had, again, still very much in this evangelical mindset that everything else in the Bible made sense, which looking back, like, how wrong can one be? But I certainly at the time thought, well, everything else makes sense. Everything else is in order. The one thing that just does not work for me, and I think it probably speaks to the fact that I'm a white male, that everything else really aligned in that sense, but certainly not when it came to sexuality. And I think that I was standing there and I was like, God, what the hell? I've tried and I've tried and I've tried to change. I met with Pastor Dane. That was a 4-year thing. When I was at Liberty, the number of weeks, this was also in high school, I would fast. I just wouldn't eat. And I would only drink like Gatorade or milk, like not together, but separately. Like those are the only two things I would allow myself to drink.
Yeah, that sounds kind of gross together.
Imagine, right? Like, but you know, I was doing other sort of questionable things at the time. It would have made sense. But I remember if you added up all of the weeks that I just didn't eat, it would have been months. Months that I simply did not eat because I was trying my best to get God's attention, to change me and show God that I was serious about this. The prayer, again, the meeting with him, with Dane, the meeting with other people. I went through like a demonic deliverance one time while at Liberty. All of these things that I had done my best to do and tried, and things still did not change. Things were not working. I was like, God, what is going on? And it was this moment of loneliness. It was this moment of hopelessness. It was a moment of desperation. I could not see how I could move forward. I think you put it better than I can a few moments ago. And so with that, I thought to myself, okay, and I had entered grad school really because I wanted to beef up my resume for when I applied to become a teacher. I was going to be an elementary school teacher. Things changed. That didn't happen. But I remember I was in my MA and I thought to myself, well, you know what? I do feel like I need to explore this question of the relationship between my faith and my sexuality. I knew of a few divinity schools and a few religious studies programs. And in Canada, divinity schools won't pay you to go or won't give you a scholarship to go. You have to pay them in large part. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go to the States again. I'm going to go back to the US and I'm going to go to a divinity school or a religious studies program. And eventually I settled on going to Vanderbilt. And it was there that I knew that they had a really, really strong program in gender and sexuality studies as it related to their divinity school. And so off I went, and I decided when I went there, and this was a big move, and I think for anyone who comes from a high-control religious context, they'll understand the gravity of this move. I decided that when I went there, because again, clearly things had not been working, And I had talked to my best friend about it, my buddy Quinny. Like, we were thick as thieves and we would just chat about this endlessly. And we would talk all about this kind of stuff. And I said to him, and eventually this was the plan. I said, you know, when I go down there, I'm going to live first and theorize or theologize. At the end of the day, theology is just theory later. Because up until that point, my theology came first. Everything was filtered through Jesus and the Gospels and loving my neighbor. Those things, by and large, are good. I think there are some problems with the Gospels and Jesus, but putting that aside, loving our neighbor is a good sort of metric by which we can live. But nonetheless, I thought to myself, I'm going to live first and theorize later. I'm going to see how my lived experience can inform this. And it was terrifying because up until that point, everything was so ordered. Everything was so neat and organized for me, right? Wrong, good, evil, of God, of the enemy, male, female, man, woman, all of this binary upon which evangelism operates. This was my world. And so to move outside of that was scary. And this was when the door started to open for me. And it was in this time, both at McMaster and at Van Dee and then beyond, where I was encountering new ideas. Up until that point, I was really only reading Christian media in high school, other than the high school assignments we were doing, which of course were not all that involved. When I got to Liberty, same thing. Like, we barely even read like novels at Liberty, and I was an English major. I think I read fewer than 10 books. We could talk about that after. I didn't have a lot of exposure to a lot of theories, and we only had one class on theory. The rest of our courses really did not incorporate theory other than our theology classes. And so for me, I didn't have exposure to a lot of theories of gender and sexuality until I got to grad school. Then I was reading authors, primary sources of folks who, of course, different worldviews than I did. On top of that, I was talking to people about these things in really concentrated, engaged sort of context, like a grad school seminar and also at the pub afterwards with a few peers, chatting with your classmates. And it was there that I started encountering a lot of difference. I think it was both by the time I got to Nashville, where again, I was starting to live first and theorize later and see how my lived experience could shape my theory, and also being introduced to a number of different voices and theories and ideas. I think these two things came together in a really profound way that ultimately slightly opened the door for my next step, which was how I believed that the Bible wasn't God's word, but instead these were words about God. And again, for anyone who comes from this world, they know that those are two very different things. And up until that point, everything was what God said, and therefore, period. There was no question anything.
Yeah. Hold that thought. So to remember where you are, I just want to go back to a couple of things. And it's reminding me of one of my kids, my youngest, who at the time, I think was 12 or 13, now is graduating college. But my kids went to Jewish day schools, and the kind where you are encouraged to have critical thinking. It's not going to work for everyone, but that's what I chose for them. And they then moved on to go to other schools that were not parochial. But they held on to this idea that within religious tradition, you can question, you can have your own feelings about things. So after my dad passed when I was young, I was handed the torch to lead the Passover Seders. So that has become my role, and it still is. And I love it. And I give out questions for people to ponder. And so we had someone there who was evangelical, and he was talking about what it all meant. And it was a friend of a cousin, and I encourage people to bring people. So he wanted to kind of give us a hard time, it looked like, because we were telling some of these stories and about the Exodus, because the Passover story is about the Exodus. And he's saying, so you really believe that Moses did this and then Pharaoh, you really believe in the staff and the thing and the plagues? And I'm thinking, well, you're a guest, first of all, how rude. But also, like, I would not do that in your home. So my daughter, who, yeah, I think she was 12, it was right before she had her bat mitzvah, she said, I don't know who you are, but to just respond, yeah, these are allegorical. Duh. And it was hilarious, but it was such a moment of, okay, where are you going to go from there, honey? Because he didn't know where to go. And that's, maybe it happened, maybe it didn't, maybe these stories are really from God, or maybe they're lessons to teach us, or maybe they're just stories. Who knows? And it's okay. We can still have our tradition. We can still align with certain ideas that we think, like loving your neighbor works for me. Let's hang on to that. That works well in the world. So also a good idea. But not everything is the truth. And to kind of free yourself of that, which is not an easy thing to do if you've been told that you're not given permission. But you also mentioned demonic deliverance. And I just want people to understand, even in like a paragraph, what that is, what that looks like, because I'm sure people are going to be like, I'm sorry, what? What did he do?
Yeah, just lost a little bit.
There are a lot of these unspoken messages that I've noticed that happen within certain environments where you were saying, like, you were feeling anxiety being not within a system. But I think when you were talking about your college experience and that you had your, basically your RAs, but not just that, you then had all of these other people who were to mind you and to watch you and to teach you. I think that you get this lesson. You can't be trusted. You need all of these handlers, basically, to keep you on the right path. And I think it sends a message. Because then when people leave these environments, they have sometimes internalized that message, sort of left to their own devices. They would make a mistake, do the wrong thing. But that's not necessarily the case. And in fact, your experience was that there was someone there doing that who wanted to actually have fun with you. So that's not, I'm sure, why he was in that position or hired to do that. But I do think it conveys a message about how much you're trusted or not, or how much you can trust yourself or not.
Absolutely. And I think about this in terms of surveillance. Liberty, you had these RAs, you had these spiritual life directors, you had these prayer leaders, all of these student leaders on your hall, who, of course, you're supposed to be looking up to them. They were in charge of, when I was there, the phrase that was used a lot by the president, then Jerry Jr., Jerry Falwell Jr., and if anyone knows what happened with him recently, with his wife and a Miami pool boy and a cuckolding relationship. If you don't know about that, just look into it. There's documentaries and books at this point on the topic. But he used to refer to, at Liberty, peer pressure in the right direction, which of course is a terrifying phrase when it's institutional pressure passed down to students who then push students in a certain way. And then you feel like if you don't do that well, not only are you going against the student leadership model and the administration, but ultimately against God. It's this really insidious way that you are following the folks who are surveilling you. And then in order not to get in trouble, you start self-surveilling and you start self-policing so that you, again, align with this quote-unquote peer pressure in the right direction, which again is just institutional pressure, which is just this crazy sort of religious system. And it all creates, again, these self-policing, self-surveilling subjects who, when they get into the real world, have no idea how to live. There's this delayed adolescence. There's this delayed maturity. There's this delayed intellectual ability, to be honest. You have a very specific ceiling as to how high you can go intellectually, and you're not allowed to go beyond that, because if you do, well, you're exceeding the system and you're no longer in line with what they believe to be God and the Bible and all of that comes along with that. So I think it's this crazy system that really breeds, amongst other things, fear and anxiety and a lot of other negative emotions. So that's definitely, I think you're 100% on the nose in how you describe Liberty and the culture of it. But to think about what you were saying with that guy who came to your synagogue, was he a Jew for Jesus?
I'm not sure. I didn't even quite ask. He just said he was from another tradition and he was curious. He wanted to know. I mean, here he is, like in my home, and he started to, I think, be irritated by something. And I don't know what it was. And maybe because we were interpreting things differently, or I'm not sure. Or maybe because we hadn't talked about Jesus yet in our Passover Seder. Whatever it was, he was getting sort of more and more irritated. And it just came out in this testing us. It was very interesting to see the hubris also. Like, I have the right to be saying this in your home, which was very interesting. It's like people who see my little thing that has sort of amulet thing that has a prayer in it that is kind of ancient, that a lot of Jewish people and even people who are not Jewish who like the tradition have on their home, but it beckons a lot of proselytizers. So there are a lot of people who come, especially during Jewish holidays or on the holiest days of the year, to try to convert me, which I don't love that.
I wonder why.
Right? That's not my favorite thing. I'll just say that. So you were asking about this guy, and then we'll talk about demonic deliverance and then go back to where you were.
I just think about more so a personal curiosity. Whenever we're talking about Christians' understandings and interactions with Jews, we're talking about a supersessionist theology, right? That they have the complete, total revelation, that they have their eyes open, and Jews are yet to have their eyes opened because they do believe that Jews or at least a remnant will be saved. And I find it's this unbelievable, dehumanizing and philo-Semitic way of viewing an entire group of people, right? They see Jews in terms of, like, we love Jews. And it's like, they don't know any Jews. They've never met Jews. Or when they do, this is exactly what they do. And I think that they see Jews as pawns in God's unfolding drama. They don't see Jews as flesh and blood people who have cognitive faculties that they can use to think about things. But instead, they're like, well, you're a Jew, therefore you will follow the script that I think about when I think about Jews. And if you don't, well, then that philo-Semitism really quickly turns into anti-Semitism. And of course, we've seen this throughout Christian history, where if you're not doing what I'm asking you to do or what I think you should do, well, I'm going to be pissed. And I might pretend in Christian love that I'm not, but of course, it's clear. But it's just this long, long history of Christian anti-Semitism that this instance makes me think of.
It gets old because it's been around for thousands of years. It's really old. Here, you were, and again, well, there's so much more to talk about, but if you can just describe what a demonic deliverance is or what it was for you.
Well, it was a lot of fun, Rachel.
Oh, I'm sure.
What happened was I lived on the part of the campus at Liberty that was called The Hill. And given their creative sort of imaginations and ability to really express themselves well, or what's the word, literalist impulse, is strong at Liberty. And of course, The Hill was on a hill. And so my dorm was up there and I was close to the missions office. And so I walked over to the missions office because I had a friend there who I don't even know what she did, but she worked there. I walked in, we're chit-chatting, and we had been friends for a while, and we had been a part of this almost like quasi-charismatic group that didn't meet on campus, to my recollection, but we met off campus and had these like prayer meetings and dinners and all this kind of stuff. And I felt very comfortable with her. She was very much like a cool Christian kind of thing. She wore cardigans, or at one time she wore a double cardigan, and I still remember thinking, or the bee's knees, like, look at that double cardigan. The fact that I knew that it was cool to wear a double cardigan, again, the writing was on the wall. I watched a lot of like HGTV and like Mitchell Reese 30 Minute Meals, but you know, people should have known. But I told her, eventually I said, well, I feel comfortable with you and you seem to be very in touch with Jesus. Maybe she's a safe person to talk about the fact that I'm gay. Or at the time I would have phrased it as I struggle with same-sex attraction. And so I did, I told her. And she said to me really quickly, she said, well, you know what? There's a guy here in this office who he's dealt with this kind of stuff before. I don't know if she meant personally, but I knew that she meant at least that he's dealt with this with other students. So I thought to myself, well, cool. She's like, do you want to meet him? And I was like, yeah, of course I do. I think this would have been my fourth year at Liberty. I can't remember if it was my third or fourth, but I'm pretty sure it was my fourth. I was desperate and I was looking for any possible exit from what I was warned about, which was the quote-unquote gay lifestyle, whatever the hell that is. And so I said, sure, let's meet. So he comes into the office. She leaves the office, brings him in. He walks in. We start talking. And then by the end of it, he had sort of surmised, I'm still so curious like how he knew this. He knew that it was the demon of Moloch that was affecting me. And again, I just love that you're talking about hubris before. I'm going to name this specific demon that's afflicting you.
I love the confidence.
Love it. I was like, well, gosh, if you know this demon by name, well, you're able to do whatever you're able to do to get this demon out. So they brought me into this other room where it was dark. And I remember it with all the lights were out. It must have been like a conference room or whatever. Went into this room and all the lights were off. They both laid hands on me, more in the Pentecostal or charismatic way of things. Not necessarily all that common for Southern Baptists to do, but they laid their hands on me. And they start praying. They were asking for the demon of Moloch to leave me alone. And I think that the way they framed it, their demonology was that it wasn't that the demon was inside of me, it was just that the demon was affecting me and like Frank Peretti sort of clawing into me just to sort of extract that that demonic influence. They sat there and prayed and I prayed and I was crying. I'm only assuming that my friend was crying and sort of this really emotional and dramatic moment. Afterwards, I thought, well, gosh, this is exciting. I'm going to leave and things are going to be different. And very quickly realized they had and nothing had changed. But again, you sort of will it on. You will it that it'll happen. You will that things will change. But of course, nothing doesn't. That creates, of course, this like very cruel optimism. You have this optimism that things will change. But the cruelty is that the object of your desire, in this case, heteronormativity or heterosexuality, was impossible from the very inception. It was never going to happen. You're chasing this carrot that, you know, isn't there.
Incredible. Incredible. All the things you've been put through. My goodness.
I remember I was distraught. I was like, God, nothing's changed. I've done everything I possibly can do. Nothing's happened. All that to say, fast forward to when I got to Nashville. Again, I started living differently. I started encountering a lot more theories that were super helpful. They were helpful at McMaster, but because of the courses I was taking at Vanderbilt, like it was much more specific to the questions I was asking about faith and sexuality and the relationship between the two. That really allowed me to live differently and to think differently. for me, the straw that broke the camel's back, which ultimately pushed me out of faith, was that I was in Florida. I did my PhD in Florida. Big mistake. No, my program was great, but Florida was not. I was there. I was sitting on my couch, and I was taking a class on Elie Wiesel. And Wiesel, perhaps the best-known Holocaust survivor, Anne Frank perhaps being the best-known victim. But Wiesel wrote Night, his spiritual autobiography from his time in a number of different concentration camps. And I had written my master's thesis on that. And then I had done my other master's thesis on Nazi propaganda. And by the time I had gotten to Florida, I had switched to focus on the intergenerational transmission of trauma between survivors and their children, and then eventually their grandchildren. When I was taking this class on Wiesel, my supervisor at the time, like, that was one of his main areas of research, was Wiesel, and he taught this course for years. I'm sitting there reading Wiesel, and I remember we're talking briefly some differences between the Christian faith and the Jewish faith. And I had never encountered anyone talk to God the way that Wiesel talked to God in a modern sense. Wiesel was saucy. This man, he came for God. He had written this New York Times op-ed, and he says to God, he's like, God, let's just figure this out. Whatever happened during the Holocaust, and now, like, you obviously weren't there. And he's talking, like, really candidly, really confidently about how God had messed up. And I'm sitting there thinking, as this recovering evangelical or slowly deconstructing person, regardless of the fact that I still didn't have the faith, or I no longer had the faith that I used to have, this was profound. Like, I was like, oh my God, you can't talk to God like that. And he was like, God, in this open letter in the New York Times saying, we need to hash it out. Let's come to terms with what happened. And after I read that, I was like, oh my gosh, how in the world could he have talked to God like that? But then that provided for me a model for how I was going to talk to God and how I was going to think about God. Even though the Protestant faith is, we're called the Protestants. I mean, they're protesting the Catholic Church. They weren't protesting God. But I thought to myself, this is a model. And that's really what started to corrode my faith, where I thought I can talk differently to God. And I don't need to talk to God with the same reverence that I always have had. But really the moment, and it was during that semester, I remember I was sitting on my couch and I took a break from what I was reading and, you know, was on Instagram or whatever. And I saw that some gal I knew had posted something about, she got a free Starbucks coffee and she was too blessed to be stressed or whatever the hashtag was, blah, blah, blah. And I'm sitting there and I'm like, wait a second, let's actually take this for what she's saying. She's saying that God blessed her with a free Starbucks coffee. And of course, I would only assume that there was a person who was experiencing homelessness, probably either right outside that Starbucks, maybe even in that Starbucks, or at least close by, who didn't get a free Starbucks coffee. And I don't know why I didn't think of all of this years before, but it was in this moment that everything came crashing down, where I was like, if God gave her the coffee, that means that God intentionally, therefore, didn't give other people the coffee or a coffee. That's effed up. And I was like, wait a second. Okay, if I think that, do I even believe in miracles? I was like, wait, can God even act anymore? Does God act? Is God good? And everything, like a house of cards, just came tumbling down. I pulled on the string in that moment. It just was like, oh, none of this makes sense. None of the teachings that I've received about God being good can be true. They simply cannot be true. And it was this moment where it had nothing to do with my sexuality. Of course, my sexuality was what opened the door, but what ultimately pushed the door off its hinges was the Holocaust. And it was the Odyssey. It was the question of evil and reconciling a good God with an evil world. And that for me is what broke my faith. I think to this day, it'd be nice to have the sense of security and assurity of what I used to have, but I think it's too high of a price to pay, because what I'd have to pay is my intellectual and emotional honesty.
Oh my goodness, this is very powerful. And I'm thinking of Robert Kushner's book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, and just, oh, and Viktor Frankl. All these people who are these amazing writers who have had to grapple with so much because of the Holocaust and because of how it all happened. And people now who are Holocaust survivors, there are just so few of them left, who are talking about how they can see what's happening in the world. It makes them have sleepless nights because they can see a groundswell that feels all too familiar. And yes, a lot of Jews right now are very anxious. It's reminding me also, when you're talking about you can't talk to God a certain way, there was a quote I remember hearing about that I think when one of the troops was going in to liberate a camp, they saw that one of the prisoners, I think most, had died. And it's interesting also the use of language, because calling these people prisoners, all the people who had to wear pink triangles, they were not prisoners, but they were called that as though they had done something wrong. There was a quote carved into a wall that you might have heard about, and it was, if there is a God, he will have to beg for my forgiveness. And it's so powerful. I mean, it shows the immense and profound loss of faith because of suffering and seeing so much suffering around you, that it is something that really tested people's faith. And there are a lot of people since then, I mean, there are Jews who are still believers. There are a lot of people who say, I would like to, but I can't because of what I went through, or because of what my family went through, or what I've heard a lot of people went through, from people who are Jewish or Romani or Russian, gay, all of it, just whatever they thought was different. What's also interesting is that, just a little thing that I was talking about yesterday, someone actually brought to my attention, they said, isn't hatred interesting that you then fit the example of what someone hates so that they can hate you more? And I said, oh, that's an interesting line. What do you mean? And she said, well, for example, and she's African-American, she said, during the Holocaust, Jews were not considered white, so they could be persecuted. But now they're persecuted because they're called white or white colonizers or whatever else. So let's just throw a label on whatever someone is so that you can hate them in that way or for that reason. And it doesn't matter if they are that or not. It's like calling gay people sinners. They're just people like everyone else. These labels are really intense to me. And I think they add to, going back to this word that I used at the beginning that I remember learning about, asking someone what it meant when they used the phrase epigenetic, that there is this transmission from being hated, of being marginalized, of being under threat. I mean, most of the Jewish people I know have a passport that is in good standing. It's just part of our DNA, I think. But what have you learned about that, about the transmission? And also, what can be done? Because for next generations to be carrying around what happened to the previous generations is a lot to load them up with. And I don't know if there's anything that can be done.
To revisit one thing you said, and then to fast forward to the question itself, you're talking about the inscription inside of the cell or one of the holdings within a camp.
Yeah, one of the barracks, I think it was. Yeah.
I think to myself about another response, which maybe is in line with what you were describing after, which was from the BBC series. Was it a series or was it a one-time thing? I don't know, because I only watched it on a DVD years later. It was called God on Trial. There's these different Jewish folks who are in a concentration camp. They're in a barracks. They are putting God on trial. They're saying, okay, where's God? What happened? You know, where is he right now? And they used, of course, the gender language of he. By the end of it, they believe and they argue that God is guilty. However, what happens is when they are then gassed afterwards is that they all essentially pray to God and are about to meet their maker and are praying sort of a reverent posture. Some people have argued, well, look at that. That seems like a very anti-intellectual, emotional response, and that's kind of crazy. However, I just think to myself about evangelicals. I mean, that's just sort of the springboard to talk about evangelicals again. And that is that despite all evidence, despite so much pain and suffering and the reality before them, they will nonetheless not give up their faith because, again, for them, and I do mean for them specifically, it is an emotional thing. So much of the Christian faith is rooted in emotion. You were talking a second after about the anatomy of hatred and sort of how different tropes lend themselves at different times to hate groups. And then the exact opposite is used. I mean, if we go back to the Holocaust, we could think about Jews as sort of this lecherous, sexualized predator against Christian women, white Christian women. Because again, like you said, Jews weren't considered white up until much later, or a few decades later, I should say. But at the same time, these sort of like effeminate wimps who, you know, are easy to knock down and beat up and whatever. Hatred's not consistent, but it does have a logic that we can see how when the time is right, hatred will lend itself here. And then when it'll lend itself here, purpose is always the same, and it's to privilege oneself over another and to find that position of power over the other. That's what comes to mind when you're talking about. Now, as for epigenetics, I'm not going to be able to answer it in the way that I think will be satisfying, in the sense that my research didn't actually touch epigenetics. It bracketed epigenetics off, read a study or two about it, but then went into less the biological transmission and more into the social transmission. What I mean by that is that when we're talking about epigenetics, for anyone out there who's unsure about what this is, it's technically not genetic transmission of trauma. It is biological, but not genetic. And what I mean by that is that the genes aren't actually changed. It's the proteins surrounding the genes. And so it is biological, and trauma is passed down this way, but it's not within the genes. It's just, it's technically outside of the genes. Anyway, not that anyone cares about this, but these are things that I care about. Anywho, I bracket this off. And I did that very much in the dissertation, which then eventually became my first book. And I talk about this. I say, like, this is something that is certainly backed by science. It's not a question as much as it is, like, to what extent is trauma passed down in this epigenetic or biological way? What I was interested in was the social aspect. Really, the question that guided my entire study was, what was it like to grow up in survivors' homes after 1945? And there had been a number of studies about children of survivors. The person who I chose to study with for my PhD, who is to this day one of my best friends, he's just this unbelievable mensch, legend, everything. I love that man. He was one of the folks who did one of the first literary studies of children of survivors. It was called Children of Job, was his book. And in that book, he does talk about the relationship between survivors and their children. However, what his study and a number of other studies talked around, and they sort of mention it, but they don't really go into any detail. The most detail was two paragraphs in another study where they talked about the homes of survivors and children of survivors. They don't talk about the actual physical space of the home and what was it like in that space. Sometimes they'll talk about stories that survivors would tell their children or things that they wouldn't tell their children. The very silence itself acted as a vehicle or a conduit to pass along this trauma and embodied knowledge. But they didn't talk about the home itself in a very physical sense. And so when I thought about the home, it comes from my own biography. And that is that my mom was a hoarder growing up. So she had mental illness that was manifesting spatially, physically, materially in our home. And I always thought about it as her mental clutter is spatializing and sort of materializing in our home, and it's building up. It eventually drowned her. She had to eventually go to a hospital. Anyway, long story short, we can talk more about Cheryl later, but this is not about her. But this was a rubric by which I understood the literature of children of survivors. And I was reading novels. I was reading short stories. I was reading poems by children of survivors. And the way that they described their homes, I ultimately, again, it's my argument that guides my entire study, is that the way that they described their homes is an indirect way of describing the relationship to the Holocaust. Of course, a belated relationship. Of course, at a generational remove. But nonetheless, a relationship that is defined by what scholars refer to as post-memory, which is really just trauma that's passed on to children, again, after the fact. And so the way that children would describe their homes, and I'll give you a good example, was I was doing an oral history. So I mostly focused on literature, but I did some oral histories as well, some interviews. I was asking this one woman, I was like, okay, can you describe your home in this interview? She's like, sure. She's like, yeah, when I grew up, me and my sister and my brother, and we would go outside a lot and we'd play in the streets. We'd go hang out with my friends until it was dark. And I was like, okay, so she didn't describe her home. And I was like, in my head, I'm like, and it didn't say anything. Right. I said, so let's go back to the question. And if you wouldn't mind, you know, describe your home growing up. She said, yeah, it was really sad inside my house, but we would go on vacations a lot. We'd go to Pennsylvania, you know, we'd go to Florida and this. I'm sitting there, I'm like, she's not describing her home. And earlier in the interview, she had said to me that she had always really struggled with what she described as, or her parents described or named as, her problem. And what her problem was that she had these panic attacks and no one knew where they came from. And eventually later in life, she realized that her problem was coming from the fact that her mom was a hidden child during the Holocaust and a lot of the stuff that came with that. So her parents just referred to this as her problem. And I thought to myself, well, she obviously connects her mom's situation to the home in which she grew up. And again, she was a hidden child. So she was inside of a cupboard. So a domestic space for however long she was in that cupboard during the war, during the Holocaust. And she'd also signaled this to me as well, that her home she identified as negatively was because she said the first time she ever had an episode where her problem sort of made itself known was when they were driving home. And I was like, okay, so the direction was home. And all of a sudden, she had this freak out. And what would happen was whenever she had one of these moments of where her problem manifested, it was where she would literally run. She would get out from wherever she was. If it was in a car and she was on her way to university, or if it was inside and she, you know, all of a sudden felt it coming on, she would all of a sudden feel this urge and she would just book it. She would start running as fast as she could and she would just run. And it was the way really of like a psychosomatic response to what she described as, and her parents described as, her problem. And so I thought to myself, she's running, like she's literally running away from what's inside her. And of course, that's an impossible goal. That's an impossible task. She's never going to be successful in running away from what's happening inside her mind that's been passed down again, epigenetically and also socially, i.e. her mom's experience of the Holocaust. And then when she wouldn't describe her home, I was like, wait a second. She's avoiding the problem. She's avoiding the trauma that defines her life, even though it's intangible. And she's avoiding describing her home. It all sort of converged where I thought about the home really is a space where you as a child, it's your first cosmos. It's your first world. It's a nexus of yourself, of your relationship to your parents, of your parents, and also their past that all come to live in and sort of express themselves in the same space. And that's really when we think of home life for children, it's really just the relationship between the past, present, future, and also between self, mother, father, and maybe siblings. And so when I started thinking about, she's not describing her relationship to her home. She's not describing her home. She's not describing the problem. She's running from it. She's still running from it. Oh my gosh. And this is where all this sort of came together for me. It was in the moment of the interview. And I said to her, I said, do you ever think about the running as like a running away from the Holocaust? And she was like, and we had to turn the tape recorder off, and she starts crying and was upset, and clearly for good reason, because she was recounting a lot of these really difficult memories and also traumas that were not her own memories, but memories that seemingly were her own, i.e. what happened during the war. And so all of this came together. And so that was the study. And so I looked at what was it like to be in the home? How did trauma manifest spatially? How did trauma manifest in how the home was decorated? How did trauma manifest in the way that parents would perhaps always keep a packed suitcase? What did that packed suitcase signal to kids? Oh, that we're going to run at any moment. The fact that they had to keep their bedroom door open at all times. Why? Because they needed to be monitored. Their parents needed to make sure that their kids were still alive. Of course, not a rational thought when they're living in a very safe, guarded, and in some cases, gated community. But nonetheless, trauma is not rational. And so looking at how survivors' experiences in the Holocaust shaped the home life, and then how that home life in turn shaped the children. And it was this cycle of children projecting what they imagined to be their parents' experiences onto the home, and then the home in turn shaping how they understood themselves. And it was this vicious cycle for a lot of children of survivors, not all of them. And of course, there were a number of folks who lived in homes that seemingly were unaffected by this. But there were, however, a number of children who lived in homes that are aligned with the way that I'm describing survivors' homes in this context. And so that was the study. And the book came out in March this year. And it's been really wild to have folks reach out and say, hey, I'm reading your book, and this is my childhood. Again, it's rewarding, but also wildly sad to think that this was anyone's childhood, that anyone's childhood is defined by such trauma.
I think it is so incredible. I'm remembering now when I had my first baby, there was a relative who had just barely gotten through the Holocaust and also had been on the Kinder transport and all of that, sent away. She wanted to hold the baby, and the way she held the baby, I mean, on the one hand, yes, I've come across people who were so loving and wonderful and kind, and it sort of makes them kind of mushy, like, oh, thank goodness, you know, there's a next generation. But she was so fraught. Her energy was so anxious. She's like patting the baby sleeping. She's patting it, like making sure it's okay. And I was thinking, I wonder what it's like, or what it was like for her own children, that they were actually fine, but that she held them and you could see the whites of her knuckles she's holding on. And I'm like, okay, that's okay. I think I'm just going to thank you so much. Why don't you have something to eat? And just sit over there with your nervous energy. I understood where it came from, but I also thought, well, I wonder what it's like to be her kid, to be fine, but to be treated like you're not, or something at any moment could go wrong. And so to have that hypervigilance and what that does to you. I want people to be able to know about your book, and if they wanted to find you and be in touch and whatever else you have online that you want people to know about, go for it. Tell people.
I'm Luke Slam Dunk Wilson on Instagram, Luke Slam Dunk Wilson on Threads, Luke Slam Dunk Wilson on Blue Sky. And then I tried to keep it very consistent, and I'm Wilson_FW on Twitter. So you can also find me on LinkedIn, Facebook. LinkedIn, I think I'm Lucas Wilson. Facebook, I'm Luke Wilson, blah, 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 blah. I had two books come out this year, but one that I think, the book about the Holocaust, it's an academic study. And so it's perhaps less of interest for a lot of people just because it's academic. And I want to be very upfront and honest about that, that it doesn't read the same way as a scholarly text. Whereas my other book that I'm very, very excited about, which came out a few months before that book, is called Shame, Sex, Attraction, Survivor Stories of Conversion Therapy. And that's my own story in group conversion therapy at Liberty. My next book, which is about queer experiences at Christian colleges, universities, seminaries, and divinity schools, which is coming out either next year or the year after. It just depends right now, sort of in the editing process. That one, I talk about my individual one-on-one sessions. I give an example or one story about when I met with my conversion therapist in the one-on-one sessions. That'll come out next year. But for right now, Shame, Sex, Attraction includes that story and includes 16 other stories of survivors' experiences in conversion therapy as told by survivors. And there is a foreword by Garrett Conley, the author of Boy Erased, upon which the film. And so that one, if you're interested in that, please pick it up. It's an anthology of stories. And again, I work academically and on a number of topics related to the Holocaust, related to conversion therapy and beyond. So if you're interested in that kind of stuff, I do talk about it on my social media quite frequently. And also I'm on like academia.edu if anyone is a big nerd and wants to read my academic work. You can read my articles there. You can find me online quite easily at this point.
All right. Thank you. Shame, sex, attraction. Oh, that's such a good, you're a wordsmith. That's really clever and spot on. It is so good to talk to you. I hope we have a chance to talk again. There's so much more to cover, but it was really good to talk to you and for people to also see your strength and that even though, yes, your book that you're talking about, well, the second book is academic, that you not only have studied things, but you've felt them and you've lived them. And so I think that it is something really important for people to see that you can move beyond it and what it takes to do that and also what community you need around you to do it and being affirmed by the world in some way to help you affirm yourself. So thank you. Thank you so much for sharing your story. And again, hopefully to be continued.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Rachel. It's been an absolute pleasure.
One more thing before you go. Thank you so much to Lucas for talking to us today. We covered a lot of subjects. Just to name a few, white Christian nationalism, conversion therapy, the Holocaust, demonic deliverance, you know, light subjects. It is really, really good to talk to someone who has decided to devote his studies to wanting to research, I think, why people do things to each other, why people other each other, and the impact that that has, and the far-reaching and multi-generational impact that that has. These are really important subjects because there are people who will say, well, they kind of give themselves permission to mistreat others and to cause people to feel like there's something wrong with them, like forcing them to do conversion therapy. Or I'm thinking even during the Holocaust or during the time in our nation's history when there were internment camps for Japanese Americans. There are so many times that people have been sequestered, pushed away, killed at times, and treated like they can't be trusted suddenly, or treated like vermin, treated like they're less than human. There is something fundamental about the need to feel superior in a lot of people, and I've never quite needed that for myself, so I don't understand that way of thinking, but I do know that for some people who either feel superior to begin with or feel so greatly inferior that they need to overcompensate by feeling superior, they can cause a lot of trouble. And they can align themselves with people out there now on the internet who are spewing a lot of really hateful rhetoric, really divisive rhetoric. When you talk to someone like Lucas, you can be really affected by the fact that he can be positive and he can move forward in his life with all that he's been through, which is kind of amazing. And I say that a lot for a lot of the people who come on this show. And I just wonder how you do it, how you put yourself together in this way. And maybe it is that you find out what it was all about and why it happened to you. And the more that you find out about this being something that people do to each other, I think, to feel superior, then you realize how little it ever had to do with you. In fact, sometimes it has nothing to do with you. And so when we also talk about the experiences that he went through, there was this quote from him, which was that he was shown a raging lack of empathy. And I know we talk about this on this show that so often, here, these are people who come on who you can tell have a good heart and they want to do good things. And suddenly they're treated with a raging lack of empathy. People who just don't care or have been taught not to care or might have the kind of wiring where they're just simply not able to care. And when you meet people like that, you kind of get shocked that they exist. It is so disheartening and kind of really uncomfortable, almost like you feel like you have to get it off of you when you're with them, because you think, this is a different kind of human than I am. This is a person who relates in a very different way and sees other people as less than, or as objects, or as things just to discard, or as things to control, or as things that need to be changed. So much of what happens within minority groups is that they're often taught that they are not okay the way that they are. They're not okay with the way that they look. They're not okay with the way that they love. But according to what and according to whom? And so I am very happy that I feel like Lucas has gotten a chance to start his life. He's gotten a chance to really see who he is and be in a world that accepts him and also doesn't make his orientation the most important thing to talk about. It is just one of the many things about him, but so what? When people leave cultic groups and when people leave more fundamentalist branches of religion, they kind of can't believe that the thing that was the number one focus for the people within that group is not really a focus in the world outside. So they get the courage up to tell someone that they are gay, lesbian, trans, or atheist, or whatever they think is shameful, even though whatever, it doesn't really matter, that's personal. And then when they're met with, okay, they wonder if the person actually heard them, because before it would have been, oh no, well, we have to do something about that. Or we have to put you through, like what Lucas was put through, a demonic deliverance, whatever that is. And so why? One of the things that I remember learning growing up was the most important thing is how you treat others. The golden rule idea, that should be important. But within these other groups that we talk about on the show, they get lost in the weeds. They get lost in the details. How long someone's skirt is, or how long their hair is, or if they prayed just enough, or if they're sitting just right while they're meditating, or whatever else, all the little details. And life shouldn't exist in the weeds. You should be able to zoom out and see big picture and realize what matters and what doesn't. So, thank you again to Lucas for coming on the show and for reminding us about what matters and what doesn't and what shouldn't. Take good care. Talk to you next week.
Thank you very much for listening. Please support Indoctrination on Patreon at patreon.com/indoctrination. Be sure to give us a follow on our social media. Find us on Facebook and Instagram using @indoctrinationpodcast. And for Twitter, find us @_indoctrination. We love hearing from you too. So send us an email at indoctrinationshow@gmail.com. And for more updates on the show, visit our website at www.podpage.com/indoctrination.